The Capital Investment Committee hearing for January 11th is called to order. Representative Ryder, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for January 9th?
I move approval of the minutes from January 9th.
Representative Ryder moves approval of the minutes for January 9th. Any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes for January 9th are approved. Members, as mentioned on Monday's hearing, we're going to have expert from the National Council of State Legislature to come and present on the core infrastructure areas that was included in the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. And as you may be aware, some of these items are not within our committee's jurisdiction, but I think it will be helpful for us as the Capital Investment Committee just to get some overview of these items, you know, for example, cybersecurity and broadband infrastructure. So with that, first on the agenda is Susan Frederick. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed. Ms. Frederick, right now your laptop or your computer is muted.
Sorry, I'll start again. Thank you, Chairman. I'm Susan Frederick from the National Conference of State Legislatures. I'm Senior Federal Affairs Counsel in our Washington, D.C. office. And I want to thank you and the members of the committee for inviting us here today virtually to give you this briefing on Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and looking ahead to 2023. I'm joined today by my colleagues, Kristen Hildreth, also with the Washington, D.C. Office of NCSL, and Erlinda Doherty, who is with our office as well. Kristen is a Senior Legislative Director for the Natural Resources and Infrastructure Committee, and Erlinda is the director, Senior Legislative Director for the Communications, Financial Services, and Interstate Commerce Committee of NCSL. So moving ahead, we're going to provide an update on the four core areas of infrastructure as outlined within the IIJA, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. And the last time we were all here testifying before you, the federal government had just begun its implementation process for many of the programs that were funded in the bill, and many of the programs were awaiting funding appropriations. And as you'll see throughout the upcoming slides, states are hard at work completing the necessary tasks and appropriating the necessary matching dollars to ensure that they can access the federal funds as those funds roll out. And our next slide, you'll see kind of the breakdown. The IIJA was just a tremendously massive package, and it gave a total of $1.2 trillion of investment in the nation's infrastructure. And while the package did include $650 billion in transportation and transportation reauthorization, it also included an estimated $550 billion in new infrastructure investment and spending over the next 5 years. Funding from the IIJA is expansive in its reach, and it addresses energy and power, infrastructure, access to broadband, internet, water infrastructure, cybersecurity, and more. So in this next slide, most of the funding is flowing through existing programs, and this is a key factor to note, as existing programs mean the federal government is much more likely to get the funds to states more quickly, given the lack of a need to develop new programs and funding streams. And as we'll see when we talk about the cybersecurity grant, that was a new program, so that needed to develop its own process to get the money out to the states. According to the federal funds information for states, the allocation estimates for Minnesota total $7.4 billion, that's a B, billion, of which most of this funding, roughly $6.1 billion, must be matched by non-federal resources. Minnesota's state budget director put together a summary to the House Capital Investment Committee just over a year ago today, breaking down the funding Minnesota is anticipated to receive over the next 5 years by state agency. As you can see in the slide, Minnesota's Department of Transportation will be responsible for roughly 75% of the anticipated funds. And with that, I will hand things over to my colleague, Kristen Hildreth.
Ms. Hildreth, please identify yourself for the record and proceed. Director Hildreth, we are muted right now.
We're just all muted with NCSL today. So I am Kristen Hildreth. As Susan had mentioned, I am NCSL's Senior Legislative Director for Natural Resources and Infrastructure. And Charlie, I'm really excited to be here with you all today to share some of this great information that I know many of you heard on Monday a little bit from your management and budget agency. But we want to go into a little bit more depth for you here, comparing where we were at a year ago today and where we're at currently, where the federal government is providing guidance or where there are open opportunities for states. So before I really delve into some of this transportation funding, I think it's really important to set a baseline for some of you and to provide a bit of background on any existing federal funding for surface transportation. And I apologize if this is a repeat for some folks in the room. It may be new for some, so we're just gonna lay it out pretty quickly. The federal government generally attempts to pass multi-year transportation authorizations that cover really a gamut of transportation modes, surface, water, and aviation, which includes roads, transit, rail, being really significantly larger than those other three portions I mentioned. These authorizations are then provided appropriations on an annual basis. For surface transportation, Congress last passed a five-year authorization in 2015 entitled the Fixing America's Surface Transportation Act, or the FAST Act as it came to be known. And in 2020, Congress extended it for another year when they were unable to reach agreement on reauthorization of it. So where does that all fit into the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act? While IJA, as Susan mentioned, included surface transportation reauthorization at $650 billion. So if I were to sum up some of the transportation provisions within the IIJA, I'd say they're really strong for states. There's a significant percentage of funding that's flowing through existing programs or formulas through states rather than competitive grants or grants to local governments, with one caveat that some of those new programs that we saw stood up are competitive programs, which states will have to be applying for. For Minnesota in particular, the IIJA represented an estimated 30% increase in overall state highway formula funding, and the Department of Transportation, as shown earlier, should expect to oversee around $5.45 billion, so almost $5.5 billion of the state's $7.3 billion total. The federal aid highway programs that you see on the screen here, federal aid highway program is typically made up of a few core programs which provide funds to states through formulas, as highlighted on the slides, which each program having a slightly different goal, although there is some overlap and states can transfer funds, a small amount of funds from one to the other. The federal government announced the apportionment of FY 2022 funds in December of 2021, so just a month after the IIJA was signed. And in October of this year, we did see the apportionment of FY 2023 funds. This is one area that I'd say we're really starting to see states get funds quickly and see the federal government roll funds out pretty swiftly. Moving on, in addition to that $300 billion that was listed as available nationally via the federal aid highway programs, there's also around $26 billion available via additional funding for a couple of new programs. I'm just going to highlight two of them, the Promoting Resilient Operations for Transformative, Efficient, and Cost-Saving Transportation Program, otherwise known as PROTECT. It's a new formula program, which is anticipated to provide around $121 million to Minnesota for infrastructure resilience improvement projects, which address vulnerability due to the effects of extreme weather and other natural disasters. Highway transit and port projects are a couple eligible uses of these funds. And in addition to those formula funds I mentioned, there's also around $1.4 billion available in competitive grants to be awarded to state and local governments for eligible highway, transit, passenger rail, and other projects. So in addition to that 121 via the formula, Minnesota can also apply to receive funds under that $1.4 billion bucket. There's also the Carbon Reduction Program, under which Minnesota is anticipated to receive around $106 million for projects to reduce transportation emissions. Of the total for the Carbon Reduction Program, of that $6.4 billion total, 65% of it is going to be for grants to counties and local governments on a per capita basis. Eligible projects for that include traffic management, public transportation, bicycle and pedestrian facilities, any congestion management technology these you may be considering, alternative fuel vehicle deployment projects, and that includes any charging infrastructure, which I'll link into another program I talk about a bit further on. Among several others, there's numerous uses under the Carbon Reduction Program. And you'll see here that there are different areas that are underlined. If you're accessing this online, you can click on each of those or hyperlinks, and it'll take you to the Department of Transportation's page for more information on where they're at. But as part of that Carbon Reduction Program, the state must develop a carbon reduction strategy within 2 years and then update it every 4. So just a caveat of what's needed to receive some of those funds.
So, Ms. Hildreth, I have a question for you before you proceed.
Yes.
So under the Carbon Reduction Program, you mentioned that about 65% of the $160 million is coming to local units of government.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way for us to figure out which local units of government in Minnesota is receiving this funds?
Yep, I can reach out to DOT, Charlie, and get you a couple, get some more information on that, and maybe some more clarification on the CRP funding to counties and other local governments.
Thank you. Chair Hansen has a question.
Yep.
Thank
Representative
you, Mr.
Hansen.
Chair. And good to hear your voice, Ms. Hildreth. The question I have is on the funds, is there a role for legislatures? So the Carbon Reduction Program, if there's a plan developed, and it's has to be developed over 2 years, is that solely an executive branch function, or is it a does the legislative branch have a role in that?
Ms. Hildreth.
Of course. Thank you so much for that question, Representative Hansen. So I think we'll delve into this a little bit towards the close of the presentation on next steps for legislatures. The legislature could choose to utilize some of their oversight responsibilities with the executive branch as they develop this carbon reduction program. So you can oversee the development of that plan. You could place certain priorities into that plan for your executive branch agency. So I think you have a pretty wide list of activities you could take if you wanted legislative priorities within that new plan. But a lot of that's going to, it's going to be drafted by your executive branch. So whether or not you choose to take various oversight responsibilities or restrict certain project types, that's going to be something that the legislature could consider.
Thank you, Ms. Hildreth. Please proceed.
Of course. So I want to move on to bridges pretty quickly. Minnesota is anticipated to receive around $320 million in formula funding for the bridge formula funding program. It will be used to conduct bridge replacement, rehabilitation, preservation, protection, and other construction uses. Of that amount, 15% is designated for bridges outside of the federal aid highway system, and it's at 100% federal funding share, so there's no state match required for that. In addition to that dedicated formula funding for bridges, the IJ does also authorize $12.5 billion for competitive grants via the Bridge Investment Program, of which states are eligible to apply for. And then I do want to talk a little bit about the substantial amount of funding that we saw within the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act for both electric vehicle infrastructure as well as for the transition from traditional gasoline or diesel powered vehicles to those which are electric and or low emitting. So the NEVI program, or the National Electric Vehicle Charging Formula Program, and its discretionary grant program for charging and fueling infrastructure, funded at $5 and $2.5 billion respectively, provide a total of $7.5 billion, of which states are eligible for, to procure and install electric vehicle chargers with the goal of building a national electric network of these chargers and to support charging communities where people live, work, shop, et cetera. That formula program does target electric vehicle charging along corridors and interstates, while the grant program will invest in charging and fueling. And that fueling will include hydrogen, propane, and natural gas infrastructure along corridors and in communities. The Department of Transportation, the U.S. Department of Transportation, and the U.S. Department of Energy did issue a joint guidance document after we met last time for this new program and really lays out where these public chargers can be built, the state cost share, and any other FAQs that states may have, their State Department of Energy, or the Energy Department within states, or the Department of Commerce, as many states link their energy programs to. And it does lay out that the state cost share for this will be 20%. They also outline any potential role the private sector may share. As of September of this year, FHWA or DOT did approve electric vehicle infrastructure deployment plans, which are necessary to receive funding under this new program for all 50 states, DC, and Puerto Rico ahead of schedule. That's something we were really excited to see. And with that approval, all states now have access to the FY 2022 and FY 2023 NEVI formula program funding. And I believe Minnesota is estimated to receive around $68.2 million under this program. I'll also mention really quickly the Clean School Bus Program, the Low Emission Transit Bus Program, and the Electric or Low Emitting Ferry Program, all to support transitioning buses and ferries to zero emission alternatives. And while these are not formula funds, states are eligible to receive them under the competitive grant process. So I'm going to call out the Clean School Bus Rebate Program here for a second. But for that program, Minnesota Pollution Control Agency did announce that it planned to offer matching funds for some school districts that apply for EPA's Clean School Bus Program rebate. MPCA indicated that its match program was established as a way to encourage as many Minnesota schools to apply for the federal funds as possible, as the funds were being distributed as a lottery process. In October of this year, EPA did announce the FY 2022 recipients of EPA's Clean School Bus Program rebate competition or lottery, and it awarded around $1.6 million to four school districts in Minnesota. And I apologize if I mispronounce these, as I am not from Minnesota, but Nicolet, Canby, Ogilvie, and Red Lake school districts all received funding to purchase EV school buses. So a total of five clean school buses will go to the state. 80% of them are truly electric. To kind of put that into perspective, EPA received 2,000 applications for the first round of funding, totaling $4 billion. So that was four times the amount of available funding that they received applications for. EPA anticipates this program to continue to be pretty competitive across the board. So MPCA's offer of matching funds is something that's really going to make the state competitive and getting a good amount of your school districts to apply for this funding.
Director Hildreth, I have two members with questions. First is Representative Carroll.
Of course.
Thank you, Chair. My question is, on the charging stations, is there a standard for the type of charging station, that is, whether it be a supercharger or a regular charger?
Director Hildreth.
Thank you, Charlie. I don't believe there is a set standard. I can go back into the charging station guidance and see if it specifies any particular models or any innovative technologies, and I can definitely get that answer to you.
Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair. So would you think there'd be an expectation that it'd be a fast charger?
Director Hildreth.
And if not, why?
Thank you. I'm going to be completely honest with you and say that I cannot answer that, but I will reach out to the Department of Transportation and check out the existing guidance that is currently out and see if there is anything outlining whether or not it is fast charging or traditional charger, and keep you posted on their answer.
Great. Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hildreth, if we were prioritizing environmental justice communities, how does having a lottery distributing the funds square with that? Is there any guidance or requirements with the funds where they're prioritizing disadvantaged communities?
Director Hildreth.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Thank you, Shirley. The For the Clean School Bus Program, EPA has a pretty robust guidance document on how they conducted their lottery process. I can't tell you the direct ins and outs at this point in time, but I'm happy to get you connected with EPA and how they kind of determine some of those communities which received funds in the lottery process. It's my general understanding that there was a prioritization in terms of getting extra points if a community was low income and or disadvantaged, but let me touch base with EPA on that and get you the exact answer, and I should have that for you within the next couple days.
Please proceed, Director.
Thank you. So for public transit, we'll run through this pretty quickly, as most of the transit funding that we see is generally operated on a federal to local structure, but I do want to leave you all with the funding that we saw for public transit is really significant. So $40 billion of that $90 billion that we see is new investment. It's the largest we've ever seen for public transit. The IIJ itself authorizes funding from the Highway Trust Fund's mass transit account for existing transit formula apportionment programs, and that includes urbanized area formula grants, rural transit and inner city bus and bus facilities, enhanced mobility of seniors and individuals with disabilities, just to name a few. Minnesota is anticipated to receive over $800 million in total transit formula funds over 5 years. Like I said, an increase of about 30% from the last year of FAST Act funding. In addition to kind of those outlays, it also includes a significant amount of funding for competitive transit grant programs. That includes the capital investment grants for fixed guideway investment, including corridor-based bus rapid transit, and then bus and bus facilities grants, which are available in addition to the state formula funding for that purpose. A couple other areas of multimodal transportation that were included funding within IJ include the availability of funding for the construction of ferry boats and ferry terminal facilities, $300 million for airport infrastructure grants and $23 million for airport terminals, all of which is really awarded by the Federal Aviation Administration directly to airport operating authorities, to local airport operating authorities, and then $32 million for railway, highway crossings, and more. On this slide, we have the funding totals for Minnesota's transportation programs under the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, just to give you an idea of just how much funding the state is anticipated to receive or is eligible for over the next 5 years to really bolster its infrastructure. I have a graphic here from Minnesota's Department of Transportation on any submitted and awarded projects. It's a little small, but I do have the link down at the bottom so you can see any projects that have been awarded funding thus far. Again, additional transportation funding, and then some other resources that I think could really help navigate the transportation funding that we're seeing. So not only from the U.S. Department of Transportation, but also from Minnesota's Department of Transportation as well. So any submitted and awarded projects, the discretionary grants list for the state, and then Minnesota has a Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act grant tracking form, which we're using to track any grants that aren't applied for by the state. I would contact the executive agencies responsible for that just to kind of gain some data behind that. It's not something that NCSL has access to, but that could be something that is curious to see in terms of what other grants are being applied for by other eligible entities within the state. And that grant tracking form is beyond just DOT. And then to get a better idea of where notice of fundings are posted, when applications are due, when funding has been or will be awarded, one can look to Minnesota's Department of Transportation Grants at a Glance calendar, which I actually found to be really helpful. It provides a fairly good idea of where funding is currently at for the state. Per the White House, so far we've seen a significant amount of funding announced to date. This is announced, not awarded, so just keep that in mind. $2 billion announced for roads, bridges, roadway safety, and other major projects, which includes $1.7 billion in highway formula funding, the $130 million for dedicated bridge funding, as I mentioned, around $100 million through the RAISE program, and then $35 million through the INFRA program. So I would just take a look at this graph here from Minnesota's Department of Transportation. And then if there aren't any questions on where the state is at in accessing some of these funds or processing applications, I would certainly reach out to Minnesota's Department of Transportation. With that, I kind of want to move into our energy program. The Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, as we know, authorized billions of dollars in funding opportunities across a wide variety of areas. That includes energy-related infrastructure. Over the next 5 years, the bipartisan infrastructure law, the IIJA, I apologize if I go back and forth between them, is going to stand up around 60 new Department of Energy programs. And that includes 16 demonstration, 32 deployment programs, expands funding for 12 existing research, development, demonstration, and deployment programs. It's pretty significant across the board. Funding opportunities authorized under IIJA for energy uses include grid modernization, new electric transmission, energy system resiliency and reliability upgrades, EV charging infrastructure, the improvement of energy efficiency to buildings, smart manufacturing, carbon capture and carbon utilization projects, renewable energy technologies, demonstration projects, and so many more. Minnesota's Department of Commerce is responsible for most of these energy and climate-related funding projects. There's also a significant amount of funding within IIJA for research and development and supply chain funding, with most of that being provided as competitive grants. There's not really any formula funds in that space. So it's really funding which states must apply for if they are eligible to. That will include funding related to batteries, including batteries of electric vehicles, both for the provision of the materials and manufacturing, as well as the eventual recycling of those materials. So any of those batteries that contain critical minerals. Research into carbon capture and storage, such as the carbon capture demonstration projects program, was recently had $2.5 billion made available for states and other eligible entities to apply to develop integrated carbon capture, transport, and storage demonstration projects that could be readily replicated and deployed at fossil energy power plants and major industrial sources of CO2, such as cement, pulp and paper, iron and steel, and then certain types of chemical production facilities. So that's just one type of the CCUS technologies and demonstration projects that is currently rolled out. And then IJ also included a significant amount of funding to support nuclear, including the preservation and operation of nuclear plants facing the prospect of early closure, demonstration of new advanced reactors, and then started to explore the ability of nuclear energy to produce hydrogen for other energy applications was also included as a research and development project. So it's really broad. A lot of the funding is under research and development, but with that, I'm going to focus on a couple of the formula funds to states. So to quickly highlight, the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act includes billions of dollars to head up a new program, the Preventing Outages and Enhancing the Resilience of the Electric Grid Formula Program. For the purposes of this, we can call it grid resiliency. Of that $2.3 billion available nationally, Minnesota, I believe, is eligible to receive around $30 million from FY 2022 to FY 2026 for projects aimed at improving the resilience of the electric grid against disrupted events. So grid resilience activities could include utility pole upkeep and removal of trees and other vegetation that would affect grid performance, undergrounding electrical equipment, relocating or reconducting power lines, improvements to make the grid resilience against extreme weather events, and more. Right now, the application is currently open for the program. Year two allocation amounts should be posted in January of this year. I haven't yet seen them. And then in March of 2023, the application will close. So there's still plenty of time for states to be applying for these funds. There's a 15% state match required for that formula program. So just to keep that in mind, that is something that the legislature may need to appropriate. Talking about the Weatherization Assistance Program next, there's around $3.5 billion available nationally for that program, of which Minnesota should be receiving around $76 million. I want to call that out because it should be receiving $76 million between FY 2022 and FY 2026, and that's in comparison to the total of $100 million that Minnesota received between 2010 and 2021, so 11 years versus five. So it is a significant amount of funding. The program itself provides low-income residents with technical and other financial assistance to help reduce their energy bills by making their homes more energy efficient. In March, DOE did roll out a program known as the states to develop their weatherization assistance guarantee plan and then issued allocations, and that program notice closed in July of 2022. The bill also provides a one-time 500. Yes?
Please proceed.
Thank you. The bill also provides a one-time $500 million allotment for DOE's existing state energy program, which provides funding and technical assistance to states for a variety of purposes, so to enhance energy security, advance state-led energy initiatives, and maximize the benefits of decreasing energy waste. It really emphasizes the role of states as a decision-maker and administrator for program activities within the state, allowing them to really select programs and different uses that are tailored to their unique resources, delivery capacity, and energy goals. The funds themselves are used to provide technical assistance to states, but may also provide funding to states via annual formula grants and competitive awards. Those funds are then used for a variety of uses, like I said, based off of individual state needs. They can be used for energy resilience, state facility retrofits, energy plan development, emergency energy planning, and more. Federal funds information for states anticipates around $8 million to Minnesota from the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, roughly two-thirds of the total amount that Minnesota has received since 2010. And I just want to call out a couple of the projects that Minnesota has used this funding on in the past, including Minnesota's 2025 Energy Action Plan, centered on consensus-driven, near-term strategies to add value to Minnesota's energy landscape, which was a coordinated effort between Minnesota's Department of Commerce and the Legislative Energy Commission and a couple others as well. Energy funding to Minnesota can be seen on the slide above. I just want to note, I talked about this earlier, but there are a significant number of new energy-related programs for which many are competitive grants and which states are able to compete for. So just keep that in mind as we start to see a lot of these grant applications roll out. If there is something that you want your Department of Commerce to focus on applying for, now is the time to start to conduct meetings with them and maybe conduct even some oversight hearings on asking them, you know, what exactly are they looking to take advantage of within the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act? And maybe how does some of that complement the work that y'all are doing within the legislature? And then one funding area that's not listed to the left, it's on my left, it might be on your right, but which states are eligible for is the program upgrading our electric grid and ensuring reliability and resiliency. It's $5 billion over 5 years. It's a new competitive program, which is going to provide federal financial assistance for states, tribes, local governments to demonstrate innovative approaches to transmission, storage, distribution, infrastructure to harden resilience and reliability of the grid. With that, I want to hand things over to my colleague, Erlinda Doherty, to go into the broadband provisions of the bill.
Thank you, Director Hildreth. Director Doherty, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Yes, thank you so much. Good afternoon or good morning. My name is Erlinda Doherty. I'm the Senior Legislative Director here at NCSL in our Washington, D.C. office, handling commerce, communications, financial services, and interstate commerce in my committee. And I'm going to apologize in advance. I have a cold that I'm getting over, so if I start coughing or anything, just that's my problem. Sorry about that. Thank you again for inviting us here to speak today and to testify on the intersection here between the federal funding and our states. And as you all have noticed, with funding of this magnitude, a whole of government approach, a true across the board federal state partnership is necessary to make this happen. So anyway, as you can see here, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act slated a major or had a major priority for their program being to fund an expansion of high-speed internet access. It provides $65 billion for this purpose. And these grant programs aim to make high-speed internet affordable for all. And these funds include planning, infrastructure, and adoption efforts to promote digital equity and inclusion. And you can see here from this information that was provided from the Internet for All website at the executive branch that it's basically broken up into two sort of overarching topics. We have the broadband access and deployment program, or as we like to call the BEAD program, and Digital Equity Act programs. The first is to, as you can see here, build high-speed internet infrastructure where it's needed to support job training, provide the equipment needed, and driving partnerships to get everybody online. And then second, the DEA programs are there to promote digital inclusion and advance equity for all communities to ensure that all communities have affordable access and can actually use the internet to improve their lives. Now, how do these programs work? Well, and how is the federal government administering the programs? Well, of course, you all had a meeting earlier this week of the House Capital Investment Committee, which we've mentioned earlier, that touched upon a portion of these funds. And obviously, as I mentioned, this requires a true state-federal partnership. And four federal agencies right now are leading this historic effort of unprecedented funding, and those are the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, the Federal Communications Commission, the Department of Treasury, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And as I mentioned earlier, these programs support high-speed internet planning, infrastructure, and adoption. And let's just discuss for a second what this all means. So planning, in the rubric of this program, includes data collection, mapping, and feasibility studies to help internet expansion projects. Infrastructure refers to actual physical needed infrastructure for high-speed internet deployment. Adoption, these are activities that ensure users can access and meaningfully use high-speed internet, and these include things like subsidies, equipment, public access, digital literacy, skills training, workforce development, telehealth, and remote learning. And the goal of these programs, again, is to achieve digital equity through improved access and intentional, inclusive planning. Because as we know, everyone in our country should have access to reliable and affordable high-speed internet. Now, the NTIA is administering the bulk of this program, $48 billion to be exact, through the BEAD program, and the digital equity program, which is $2.75 billion, and the $2 billion Tribal Connectivity Technical Amendments Program, and finally the $1 billion Enabling the Middle Mile Broadband Infrastructure Program. So again, these are all programs that are of interest to you and are all being administered by the NTIA. Now, the funding pool in the DEA is also, the Digital Equity Act program is also important, and the $2.75 billion here contains $60 million in funding for states to develop digital equity plans, $1.44 billion in formula funding to implement plans and promote digital inclusion, and $1.25 billion in competitive funding to implement digital equity and inclusion activities. Also critical is the Middle Mile Grant Program, which provides $1 billion to invest in the construction, improvement, or acquisition of middle mile infrastructure, which is essentially the midsection of the infrastructure that carries large amounts of data, high speeds over long distances, and connects the backbone of the internet infrastructure to the, quote, last mile or end users. Next slide, please. Thank you. Now, this slide tries to show a little bit of the timeline here for the deployment and execution of these programs. And as you can see here, a lot of the NOFOs have already gone live last May, And a lot of the planning has already been underway, and you can see that this is a long-term plan basically stretching out into 2026. Now, already Minnesota is going to be or has been allocated $180 million to be used for broadband funding. And NTIA has already, again, been administering a lot of the funds to several states. And you can see here, again, the timeline for when these, how the funds are expected to be used with a four-year, you know, average implementation timeline. Now, what's also of particular interest, we've been waiting for some time now for the Federal Communications Commission, or the FCC, to release maps. And this, again, was a major development which just happened before or around Thanksgiving, I believe. I can't remember exactly the date now, but just around, oh yeah, right before Thanksgiving. And essentially, these are maps that were essentially supposed to show where the gaps in the broadband coverage was around the country. And because before that we were using census maps, which were not really that accurate. So the FCC released some, they like to call them pre-production drafts, because essentially, even though these were maps that were revised from the census version, they are encouraging everyone, states, localities, communities, to essentially challenge the maps that were released to make sure the data actually reflects the reality of what's happening in your state or locality. And the challenges are actually supposed to be submitted by January 13th, so obviously very quickly, with the corrections to be incorporated into the final version of these maps that will be allocated or due to be released shortly and to be allocated with the BEAD funding that's due to be allocated in June 2023. Now, when can states expect to see these funds, and what is the sort of timeline? Again, I've kind of tried to explain or show graphically here what this looks like in this chart. But states have already started to receive BEAD programming for BEAD funds for programming and implementation and planning. And again, the five-year plans should be on every state's to-do list right now. BEAD funds are expected to start roll out, as I mentioned earlier, for implementation by June of 2023. And so this is a historic opportunity, as you know, for states to address this hugely important problem in our country. And there are many guidelines and many, resources available, both on our website, but also on the Internet for All website. That the administration released a little bit ago that talks about ways for states to prepare for this funding, for states to coordinate with localities, to put together proper plans in order to ensure that funds are being distributed and used properly. And again, this is viewed as something that is a partnership across all levels of government. Again, those are some important resources to check out as this funding is getting allocated. And that is all I have right now on this funding, if there are any questions.
Ms. Doherty, I do have a question for you. So for the funding, whether that's BEAD or DEA, are there funding in there to upgrade current infrastructure that may not be able to take on high-speed internet to, you know, when you talk about equity? Example will be in Minneapolis, where in North Minneapolis, we may not take on high-speed internet like other more affluent part of Minneapolis. And so the question is there funding within those two programs to improve on the high-speed capacity of current infrastructure?
Yes. Yes, sir. Exactly. There is. And again, part of that is part of that discussion or that funds are included in this talk about how to update the maps that we have, you know, how to make sure that the maps are displaying the current situation in your communities. So I encourage, you know, you all to check out this FCC map or the pre-production drafts that were sent out, released earlier. But yes, also in general, the core basis for this, all of this funding was to enhance, current programs and current infrastructure to bring them up to speed, literally and figuratively, for high-speed internet.
We have a question from Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair and testifiers. My question is around the equity plan.
plan for digital inclusion. My understanding is that here in Minnesota, Minnesota Deed will be taking the lead with the governor's office. And are there any guidelines that you've provided to states about how that outreach and engagement, for example, with the disabilities community or rural communities who may lack access and are currently underserved or unserved, that we would be able to have as legislators to have oversight and ensure that there's really robust engagement as that plan is being developed?
Director Daugherty.
Yes, thank you, sir. And thank you, ma'am, for the question. There are NTIA has done a really good job of trying to provide lessons learned and templates for how states can work with various interest groups and stakeholders within their communities to work together to make sure that the funding is distributed in accordance with the spirit of the goal here. So again, I would encourage you to check out you know, what the NTIA has put out already. We had many meetings with the NTIA and the FCC to talk about resources and communication and tools that can be shared with states and localities to make sure that that is available to everyone to make sure, you know, for that purpose. So I would encourage you to check out those resources, as I know that they have gone the extra mile to make sure that those were available.
Please proceed. No more questions.
Thank you.
I'm going to move on to our water section at this point in time. Most of this is going to be a pretty quick overview just to account for time, but all the information will be available here on the slides. So of the $55 billion that was provided for water and wastewater infrastructure, we saw $11.7 billion nationally for EPA's Drinking Water State Revolving Fund and the same amount for its Clean Water State Revolving Fund, both key state federal partnerships. $15 billion provided for lead service line replacement and $10 billion to address PFAS, per- and fluoroalkyl substances, and other emerging contaminants. So our Drinking Water State Revolving Fund helps state water systems and states achieve public health protection objectives under the Safe Drinking Water Act and provides assistance to improve water treatment and repair old pipes, just to name a couple of the allowable uses. While the Clean Water State Revolving Fund provides assistance for projects such as the creation of municipal wastewater facilities and controlling non-point sources of pollution, just to name a few, there are also a number of uses under the Clean Water State Revolving Fund that can be used for climate resiliency efforts and green infrastructure, of which EPA has a document on. For both the Clean Water and the State Drinking Revolving Funds, state allocations are going to increase in amount for FY 2022 to FY 24, and then they're going to plateau for the last 2 years. 49% of those funds must be administered as grants or other principal forgiveness loans. And then for the purposes of the influx of this funding, and I just want to stress this really quick, that state match is going to be reduced to 10% from the traditional 20% for FY 2023 to 2022 and 2023, and then increase back to 20% unless Congress passes legislation stipulating otherwise. But based on the current makeup of Congress right now and the general direction, I don't envision that happening. So just keep in mind, it's 10% for 2022 and 2023 funding, and then will increase back to 20% for 2024 to 2026, which is something that the legislature may need to appropriate.
Director Hildreth, I have a question for Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Hildreth. I'm going to go to the green infrastructure under the traditional clean water revolving funds. So if the state of Minnesota wanted to use that money for planting trees as green infrastructure, is that allowed?
Director
Hildreth. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Thank you, Chair Lee. The planting of trees, I'm going to have to look into EPA's green infrastructure requirements and see just exactly what some of their allowable uses are, but I can do that for you. If it is a planting of trees, I believe it would have to be part of a larger plan as part of that green infrastructure project. And potentially even clan specific. I know there is some use of native plants as storm barriers, etc. So let me do a little bit more of a deep dive into what you're looking for, and I can let you know if that planting would actually apply in this sense.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Hildreth. We've had in the past programs for wellhead protection areas with native planting or tree planting. So I think there's Department of Health programs, but the question, I guess, if it is applicable, where is the decision made? Would the legislature need to provide the guidance, or does the executive branch have complete control over the decision?
Director Hildreth.
Thank you for that question. It's going to really depend on if the legislature wants to identify certain project priorities for the executive branch to undertake or consider. And I'm going to use Virginia as an example because their legislature has actually outlined in statute what sort of project types they would allow their SRF funds to be used for. And green infrastructure is one that they added, I want to say, within the last 10 years to their SRF project eligibilities under their Clean Water State Revolving Fund. And I'm happy to share some information on what Virginia has done. I believe a couple other states that are in the Chesapeake Bay region have taken similar action in requiring or restricting certain project uses, but it really depends on what your legislature is looking to do. If you don't have anything that would right now restrict your executive branch agency from using these SRF funds for green infrastructure, then that's gonna be a priority that your executive branch agency would have to undertake. But I'm happy to get you more information on what exactly the legislature could do if they so choose.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be very helpful, as well as if you could provide the Virginia template.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Director. I was just wondering, I live in a municipality that they provided like low flush toilets and or helped people with the purchase. Would this be available for helping people with that statewide maybe, or and then helping with within the homes, because there's people that are less affluent, and helping them with lead service and other things inside the home and the costs related to plumbing and that sort of work.
Director Hildreth.
Thank you so much for that question. So it's my understanding that any of the funding for any sort of lead mitigation is going to have to be outside of the home, so it won't consider any fixtures once you pass that home barrier. As for the low flush toilets or water conservation within the home, I'm going to connect with my folks over at Clean Water Administrators and see if they have any instances of states doing that. On my general understanding of the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, though, is that that would not be an allowable use. But let me just make sure I'm correct before I tell you that, and I'll get an answer from Mark Clean Water folks by the end of the week.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Director, and thank you, Mr. Chair.
Please proceed.
Thank you for that. Just moving on, this goes into the traditional drinking water SRF. Like I said, it's a financial assistance program to help states and water systems achieve those health protection objectives. Minnesota, I just want to put this info on here for you all. It's administered jointly by your Public Facilities Authority and your Department of Health. Some past uses that you all have employed include treatment, transmission, and distribution, consolidation, storage development, and new system creation. Similarly, for the Clean Water State Revolving Fund, it's administered jointly by your Public Facilities Authority and your Pollution Control Agency, with a couple of past uses, including the construction of municipal wastewater facilities, controlling non-point sources of pollution, and green infrastructure, which we just touched on. On those, in addition to those traditional SRF activities, I mentioned the $15 billion for lead service line replacement and any associated activities. That's going to be administered through the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund. So this is an area that we're seeing funds roll out to states really quickly based on how quickly the states can get EPA, their intended use plans. But for that $15 billion, 100% of that is actually for lead service line replacement. And It is specifically for lead service line replacement activities, projects and associated activities connected to the identification, planning, design, and replacement of lead service lines. So corrosion control treatments are not eligible for funding via this new pot. States aren't required to provide any cost share, and then 49% of that funding must also be provided as grants and completely forgivable loans. Some of you may have heard me say this before, but state and local fiscal recovery funds can also be used for lead service line replacement. I just want to add that in as maybe you start to communicate with the PFA about the use of these funds, but those state and local fiscal recovery funds can also be used for lead service line replacement projects if recipients replace the full line of the service line and not just a partial portion of the line. If anyone's interested in that, I can get you connected with our drinking water folks.
Director Hildreth, we have a question from Representative Erdahl.
Of course.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And you have an item here, Minnesota-specific, the Public Facilities Authority. Under this, how much funding could the PFA expect?
Director Hildreth.
Thank you so much for that question. And I'm going to jump ahead to show you. So here's what we're looking at for FY 2022 to FY 2026 funding, including all of that SIT revolving funds. We're looking at a total of $735 million. And this is across the PFA and pollution control and the drinking water administrating. But here's a general breakdown. So you can anticipate around $170 million for your drinking water state revolving funds. That's traditional. And that may fluctuate a little bit with EPA's next drinking water needs survey assessment, but it shouldn't really change too much. Around $204 million for the clean water state revolving fund. For the lead service line portion, we're looking at $217 million. For emerging contaminants and PFAS, which I'll get to in a second, you're looking at $58 million under the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund, $17 million under the Clean Water State Revolving Fund. And then there's around $67 billion under the Small Disadvantaged Communities Grant Program, under which emerging contaminants funding is going to be seen. So a pretty significant amount. I do want to note, though, that just this traditional drinking water and clean water state revolving funding is going to have a state match requirement.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And maybe I'll just jump ahead here while I've got the floor. What is the – there are a lot of numbers being bandied about here. What – and maybe you've covered it through this – but what is the total amount that Minnesota is going to get under these combined categories? Do you have that figure?
Director Hildreth.
Thank you so much. For just the water funding or for total Minnesota?
Total.
All right. I'm going to jump back before I give you the wrong numbers. So just bear with me here for one moment. We are looking at a total of $7.4 billion for Minnesota. $7.4 billion. And 6.1 of that is going to have to be matched by non-federal sources.
Representative Erdahl.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Kozlowski.
Thank you, Chair. My question, jumping back to the lead service line replacement, is are there allowable or ways that communities can get creative, for example, as residents may be awaiting replacement, could some of the funds be used for, say, filter until the full line can be replaced? And then my other question is also jumping off that same vein. I'm really proud to say that in my community, we paired residents who are most disproportionately impacted within census zones, as well as paired the line replacement with other things like, for example, who would receive infrastructure improvements in their streets. And I'm curious if that is at all part of the equation in terms of either guidelines or recommendations that we could be looking to really ensure that there's equity for residents who are having to endure the lead lines in their homes, but also looking more broadly at how we might cut across in a broader view with across our infrastructure, pairing lead with, you know, our streets and roads.
Director Hildreth.
Thank you for that question. So under this lead service line replacement funding, it won't be able to be used for any sort of filter use within the home. I'm happy to connect with the Association of Drinking Water Administrators who deals with this lead service line replacement or just lead in home, lead drinking water on a pretty regular basis and see if they've seen any uses of the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund for that filtration piece. But let me check with them and get back to you on the ins and outs of some of these allowable uses. They get a little tricky. And as for coordinating sort of the replacement of these lead service lines, say with new road construction or the underlaying of broadband, we have seen a couple of municipalities take that sort of action. And I had a conversation, I believe it was the National Association of Counties a few years ago on states or municipalities, I should say, pairing their infrastructure replacement with other needs. And I'm happy to connect with them again and see if we can get some examples of that for you that are more cross-cutting.
Representative Kozlowski, follow-up?
No, thank you.
Please proceed, Director.
Thank you. Just quick other lead replacement activities. So it does include a significant amount of funding for other lead mitigation related programs, such as funding for EPA's Assistance of Small and Disadvantaged Communities program, supports a lead inventorying pilot program, and then authorizes funding to address lead contamination in schools. There's $500 million for EPA's Assistance of Small and Disadvantaged Communities grant that assists small and disadvantaged communities with improving their drinking water resources. Those funds are awarded as non-competitive grants to states with the aims of really helping public water systems in underserved communities meet and comply with your Safe Drinking Water Act needs. That funding is awarded based on an allocation formula similar to that of the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund. So I've got that listed on the next slide. And I would really encourage, especially on a lot of this SRF funding or the new lead funding coming down, to get in touch with Minnesota's regional EPA office, along with your PFA or the Pollution Control Agency, or if I go back, Minnesota's Department of Health, just on some of the allowable uses or where you're currently looking at putting this funding in your intended use plans, and maybe some innovative uses as well. But I would definitely recommend connecting with EPA's regional office. For folks in the room, that's Minnesota Region 5, and I'm happy to get individuals who are interested to contact for them after this. Like with lead, you know, we saw the $10 billion for PFAS and other emerging contaminants. There's no state match required for these funds. 100% are to be administered as grants and completely forgivable loans. We talked about the significant amount of funding going to Minnesota in this water infrastructure space. And I really want to stress, and I've done this in the last couple slides and questions, but states really have a key role in the state revolving fund process. So your executive branch agencies develop intended use plans and project priority setting. You solicit projects and make funding decisions based on your state priorities. Your state is managing the day-to-day operations of your state revolving fund programs and are responsible for the long-term planning and financial health of your SRF. Your legislature, if you so choose, can conduct an oversight hearings of your executive branch in terms of how they're prioritizing projects, what sort of intended use plans they plan on submitting, oversight of the financial health of the funds, or even going so far as a couple other states have, where really accessing some of that legislative authority to maybe restrict or identify specific project areas that you want the funding to go to. So you have really a wide swath that you can take in accessing and kind of directing some of these funds. I do want to note that you can't earmark the funds, but you can prioritize them, if that makes sense. On this slide, I also show the anticipated totals in Minnesota, but broken down by year and by program. Just keep in mind here that the calculations are provided by federal funds information for states. They're not official calculations. They are estimates based on existing formulas. They are generally in line with what EPA has at the moment for 2022. But that drinking water formula, like I said, might shift a little bit. I don't think it's going to shift much for Minnesota, but just to keep that in mind. The last time we were here, EPA really had just begun developing guidance for states with instructions on how to apply for these supplemental funds, with the anticipation that of that arriving by the end of February. With March 22 as the first influx of funding coming to states, well, some of that held true, some of it didn't. Last March, EPA released their bipartisan infrastructure law, state revolving fund implementation memo, and in the spring and summer of 2022, states began the development of their intended use plans for the SRF funding and began submitting applications to EPA for the FY 2022 capitalization grants. Relatedly, in June of this past year, EPA opened the application for states to apply for funding to address PFAS and other emerging contaminants in their small and disadvantaged communities. States had until August to submit a letter of intent to participate in that program to receive allotment. Starting this past fall, states began to receive some of the SRF funding to kick off drinking water and clean water improvements. And related to that, due to the disadvantaged communities requirement within IIJA, according to EPA, at least 22 states have reviewed and/or revised their state's definitions of disadvantaged communities and altered their affordability criteria under the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund and Clean Water State Revolving Fund to increase the flow of investment to those specific communities. If folks in the room are interested in hearing more about that, I'm happy to get you connected with EPA's Office of Water. They have worked with states across the board and they've looked to update that definition.
Director Hildreth, we have a question for you from Representative Hansen.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was Minnesota one of those states that updated their definition?
Director Hildreth.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. Based on my research prior to this, they were not listed, but does not mean that they did not reach out to EPA to look to do so.
Please proceed.
Thank you. On December 16th of 2022, so just a few weeks ago, about a month ago now, Minnesota approved its 2023 intended use plans for both the Clean Water State Revolving Fund and the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund. Emerging contaminant and PFAS funding, part of it was included within the intended use plan for the CWSRF. And for the lead service line, or for the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund, that included some of the lead service line funding and the emerging contaminant funding under that bucket as well. The IUPs identified projects and activities that the PFA intends to fund from both of those two buckets of money in state fiscal year 2023, including the use of the federal funds from the first year of IIJA. So let me go back one time. I'm not sure if you can see it, but at this time, because the legislature had not appropriated the required state matching funds for the 2023 base for the IJF supplemental capitalization grants, the PFA intends to apply for but can't draw on the IJ supplemental or the 2023 base capitalization funds until state matching funds are appropriated. So that's just to note. So at this time, and Minnesota included it in the letter that they released, the 2023 CWSRF and Drinking Water State Revolving Fund can only include carryover projects in the fundable range due to a lack of that state matching fund. So just to keep that in mind on projects that can be completed at this point in time.
Director Hildreth, we have another question from Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Hildreth. So when the state if the state provides matching funds, they could put criteria, different criteria in contingent on the matching funds. Would that be correct?
Director Hildreth.
That's my understanding, correct.
Please proceed.
So on this slide, I have some of the other water provisions in the package that impact Minnesota. I'm not going to run through them just in an effort to save time because I know we're hitting it. But we see a significant amount for Great Lake restoration, combined sewage overflows, underground injection control grants for class 5 wells, Western Water, and more. And then the bill does include a $21 billion investment to clean up Superfund and brownfield sites, reclaim abandoned mine land, cap orphaned oil and gas wells. EPA and DOI are well underway in getting a lot of this funding to states. I just want to really focus on maybe Superfund and brownfields really quickly. But the Superfund program is going to fund around $3.5 billion to invest in cleanups and continue with remedial actions for Superfund sites. The section here does waive state cost share requirements. When we were last here, EPA had just announced its first $1 billion use of that funding to target projects on the federal Superfund priority list, of which Minnesota has had 24 sites listed dating back to 1983 and as early as 2022 with the Southeast Hennepin Area Groundwater and Vapor Superfund. So that's really your only active project right now on the NPL. In Minnesota, the Pollution Control Agency does determine sites to place on the state list per the Minnesota Environmental Response and Liability Act, and then refers any necessary sites to EPA for the federal Superfund priority list. The first wave of bipartisan infrastructure law, or IIJA funding, allowed EPA to approve the initiation of work at all 49 Superfund sites with backlog remedial construction projects. In 24 states and territories, and then also obligated funding to start new construction projects at 44 of the 49 NPL sites that were identified in December. For brownfields as well, there's around $1.5 billion to be distributed over 5 years for state and tribal assistance grants, allowing states to assess, clean up, reuse contaminated properties, which would be determined by the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. And most of that funding is going to be provided by competitive grants, while the remainder is allocated as categorical grants, of which all state cost share requirements are waived again. The MPCA has around $2 million that they were allocated between FY 2022 and 2026 available to fund brownfield environmental assessment work in areas of concern for environmental justice. And I think with that, I'm going to cover disaster mitigation resiliency provisions really quick before handing things over to my colleague, Susan Frederick. But IIJA was, as we talked, huge across the board in a number of areas, but also had a significant amount of funding for disaster mitigation and resiliency. And it's not just a one-time influx of funding. The funding for the majority of programs listed is going to be split over 5 years, with states having various lengths of time to fully utilize the funding in the best possible way to fit the unique needs of their communities. As no two disasters are the same, no two mitigation measures are the same either. And so a lot of responsibility and deference goes to states in accessing and determining projects for which these funds will be used. FEMA's Flood Mitigation Assistance Program saw its funding tripled, with $3.5 billion provided in competitive grants allocated across FY 2022 to FY 2026. And that program provides funds to state and local governments for projects that reduce or eliminate the risk of repetitive flood damage to buildings insured by the National Flood Insurance Program via buyouts, elevation, other activities. In order to receive assistance for these funds, states, local, and tribal governments are required to develop and adopt hazard mitigation plans. The FY 2022 funding application does close at the end of this month. And if there are any questions on this, I would check in with the Minnesota Department of Public Safety and with your state hazard mitigation officer in particular on any updates. Similarly, FEMA's Building Resilient Infrastructure and Communities Program replaced FEMA's pre-disaster program in FY 2020. It was funded at $1 billion over 5 years with $200 million each year. It provides funding to states and local governments to strengthen the resilience of critical infrastructure, and that includes transportation, energy, water supply, and communications. Supporting all the above as states and local governments undertake hazard mitigation projects, reducing any risks that they may face from disasters or natural hazards. Like the flood mitigation program, the funding application also closes at the end of the month. And then the storm or safeguarding tomorrow through ongoing risk mitigation act provides state and local governments with the ability to create resilience revolving loan funds for infrastructure projects that would protect against catastrophic events. So it includes wildfires, earthquakes, flooding, and more. The act authorizes $500 million over those 5 years to support states to establish a revolving loan funds to provide hazard mitigation assistance to local governments to reduce risks to disasters and natural hazards. And they may finance water, wastewater, infrastructure, disaster recovery, community, and other business development projects. In other hazard mitigation assistance programs, states and federally recognized tribes are typically pass-through entities to which route sub-applicant requests to FEMA for review. But through this storm revolving loan program, FEMA empowers states to make financial decisions and award loans directly, so that revolving loan fund will help local governments carry out hazard mitigation projects that reduce disaster risks across the board and help them build resilience. It is modeled off of the drinking water revolving loan funds that I just talked a little bit about earlier. If you're interested in hearing more about STORM, I'm happy to talk with you offline, answer any questions, and or direct you on over to FEMA. It's a new program. They're just heading it up. There's a lot of action going on in that space at this point in time. With that, I'm going to hand things over to my colleague, Susan Frederick, to talk cybersecurity.
Director Hildreth, before you move on, I know one priority of many of the members on the committee that wasn't covered was ports. Can you talk a little bit about the port funding that's available through IIJA?
Sure. So IIJA had a significant amount of funding for ports. Some of that fell under the ferry buckets, some of it fell under, I believe, some of the Army funds got some port funding included. I'm happy to pull more information of that and send it to Jenny to share with the committee so it's more accurate and list out if any Minnesota in particular is eligible for.
Thank you. Please proceed. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Before we move on to cyber, I just want to add on to the disaster piece. So one of the priorities of NCSL before the end of the year was getting some of this, some of our unanswered requests dealt with in the omnibus bill. And one of the pieces that was included in that package was an ARPA flexibility bill that, among other things, allows states and localities to use some of their ARPA money toward disaster mitigation and recovery. So I wanted to make sure that you knew that. It allows a greater amount of flexibility to use existing funds that you've already received through ARPA toward that particular use. So I wanted to flag that for you before we move on. And now I will go ahead and talk about cybersecurity and the new state and local cybersecurity grant program, which is the first of its kind and is a dedicated cyber grant program for states and localities. Just as a quick review, there's $1 billion appropriated over the next 4 years, and DHS, Department of Homeland Security, is the subject matter expert, while FEMA will provide grant administration and oversight for this program, which means the cybersecurity agency within DHS will approve your state's final state cyber plan and any individual projects referenced in that plan for that grant application. So as I mentioned, $1 billion over 4 years, there is a state matching requirement and a submission of a state cyber plan that is required. With respect to the state match for FY22, there is a 10% match, which can be a hard match, which is cash in hand, or a third-party in-kind or soft match. The states must agree to make available non-federal funds to carry out the award in an amount not less than 10% of the total project cost. So the federal share will not exceed 90% of the total budget as submitted in the application and approved in the award. The applicant in this instance is going to be your state administering agency. That is the only entity that can apply for the grant. Minnesota did apply, and I'll go into that in just a moment. Localities will receive sub-awards through the state. Under this program, as mentioned in other programs under the IIJA, federal funds cannot be matched with other federal funds. So you have to come up with your 10% match separate and apart from any federal money you may have received. You cannot use federal money for the federal match. And as you can see on the slide, there are some prohibited uses expressly stated. You may not use the funding to pay off a ransomware attack. You can't use the money off for the obvious non-cyber purpose. It has to be cybersecurity related. And you may not supplant state, local, or territorial funds to do this. So go ahead to the next slide. And here we see the total grant award for FY22 across all the states and territories is $183.5 million, and that amount is based on population. The notice of funding opportunity for this fiscal year went out in September. Minnesota did apply, as I mentioned, and received $3.6 million for FY2022. The Department of Homeland Security does not make public the application and what was requested in the projects in the state cybersecurity plan. So you would definitely need to contact your Minnesota Department of Public Safety, Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for state-specific requests that were made to the department. And I did get the name of a person over there, Michelle Tuberville, who is the contact for DHS in your state. So Minnesota's share is about $3.6 million for FY2022. And I would urge you to hop on CISA's informational website, which contains all the grant requirements and the 18 things that needed to be submitted in the grant application for this award. And I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about the grant program itself. NCSL has a very good relationship with CISA. We work with them to make sure that we get as much information out to you all in the states as we can. And I'm going to go ahead and move on to our few remaining wrap-up slides here. And, you know, I think the next thing we need to talk about a little bit is the next steps for state legislatures with respect to this humongous bill. Some bullet points and some guidelines for you all. Review the federal guidance for new and existing programs. It's important that you know what you're getting into and what your requirements are for any federal dollars that you receive. Develop legislative priorities for the state agencies to carry out and consider agency hearings and associated oversight. So look at what you want to prioritize, which grants you want to specifically apply for, you know, what is important to your state with respect to this funding. Consider legislative approval for funds or executive branch agency actions. So determine whether to provide matching or additional tax credits, for example. Reach out to your congressional delegation, particularly regarding any earmarks you might feel are there or appropriate or not. And use NCSL staff, which I know you guys do, and we thank you very much for that, for these opportunities, to connect with federal officials and intergovernmental offices. Here at NCSL in our Washington, D.C. office, we work regularly with the agencies, with the federal agencies in pretty much every subject matter area you can think of. And we are very happy to connect you directly with subject matter experts in the federal agencies who can answer your specific questions about your state allocations. So next steps, the funds allocated to Minnesota could go toward whichever investments you deem most necessary. Electric transportation infrastructure, electric transit, weatherization, energy efficiency, power and grid. So make the, you know, be thoughtful about those considerations. We're happy to help guide you if you need it. Collaboration is key. You can move to the next slide, Kristen. Facilitate a holistic approach which optimizes the engagement of those who use Minnesota's infrastructure. Coordinate and align strategies for infrastructure management. Is the infrastructure effective and efficiently maintained or controlled or operated? And invest. So we recommend and advocate for adequate funding for the infrastructure to fully access the federal funding available to the state. And of course, prioritization is key here, and all of that. I know we're getting tight on time, really tight, so I'm going to try to race through the rest of this. Obviously, we are happy to answer any questions that you might have. Here's a list of some resources that we urge you to use, and you know, feel free to email any of us, any of the three of us, and if we're not the right person to answer your question, we will provide you with contact information for someone else at NCSL who is. So with that, I would like to thank the committee and the chair. And if there's any residual questions, I think we have just a few minutes left. I'm happy to try to answer as many of those as we can. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Frederick, for the presentation, and to your other colleagues who are testifying in front of our committee. Seeing no questions from our members, just want to say thank you again for sharing what you know about the information from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, and also, you know, your continued support of us here in the state of Minnesota. Members, our next meeting is on Wednesday, January 18th, and on the agenda is the University of Minnesota and Minnesota State for bonding updates and the capital expenditure reports. Please note that we will not meet on Monday, January 16th, as that's Martin Luther King Jr. holiday. This meeting is adjourned.